Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A day after President Bush sought to reassure Americans about the war in Iraq, 46% of Americans surveyed by USA Today, CNN, and Gallup say he achieved that goal. But major newspaper editorials today took issue with key parts of the speech. The Los Angeles Times called it a major disappointment that Bush once again lumped together 9/11 and the need for war in Iraq. And while the Washington Post agrees with the president that Iraq is now a battleground against terrorism, the newspaper says the president missed an opportunity to level with the American people about how long the war will last and how many troops it will need. On the CBS Early Show this morning, Republican Senator John McCain joined Democrats in criticizing the president's assessment that no new troops are needed.
I'd send more troops over there, but I'd have to also take in consideration that our Army, Guard, and Reserve are very badly overstressed. But I would have had more troops over there for a long time.
Opinions are flying today, but the day after, we get a fact check of the president's speech from Washington Post reporter Robin Wright. Robin, hello.
Nice to be with you.
And first thing we want to note is that while 46% of the respondents to the USA Today poll felt positive about the president's speech, 50% of the respondents identified themselves as Republican. So the president actually didn't get all of his party's support in that poll. But Robin, give us your headline. Overall, how would you characterize this speech in terms of factual accuracy?
Well, there were several statements that were true. The fact is that the Iraqi government has been formed successfully, that the Iraqis have managed, despite this insurgency, to keep to the general timeline of the three-phase transition. The big question, of course, is whether they can write a new constitution in just 6 weeks now. It's also true that there has been success in both the quantity and quality of a new Iraqi security force. The reality, however, is that there were 150,000 international troops at the time of the ouster of Saddam Hussein. They are still there, and yet there are 160,000 new Iraqi forces, according to the president, that are still unable to handle or cope with the insurgency. On other fronts, the president said that this was a moment in history that was transforming the region, and he credited the Iraq War with inspiring the Cedar Revolution in Lebanon and changes as well in
the Middle East.
Across the Middle East. But the fact is that Yasser Arafat's death really was the pivotal moment in opening the prospects of talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians and a renewed U.S. role. And in Libya, there was a long-standing effort begun during the Clinton administration to disarm Gaddafi of his weapons of mass destruction. And the suicide bombing of Lebanon's opposition leader really was the key to the withdrawal of the demands, anyway, for Syria's withdrawal. So there are other flashpoints that really triggered those events.
Well, I want to move on to another point. The president also repeatedly referred to the insurgents in Iraq as terrorists and foreign terrorists. Iraq specialist Anthony Cordesman and the Wall Street Journal both today note a leaked CIA report that claims that Iraq has replaced Afghanistan as an extremist breeding ground. But Cordesman points out that only 5% of the Iraq insurgents are foreigners. The rest are native Iraqis. It's a mischaracterization of the insurgency.
Indeed, and also the status of that insurgency. The General Abizaid said just earlier this month that there are today more foreigners moving into Iraq than there were 6 months ago, which reflects the kind of growing challenge we face in dealing with the most deadly aspect of this insurgency, which are the suicide bombings.
But in fact, growing from, you know, it's still a smaller number than the president indicated. The president said 30 nations are providing troops in Iraq and that $34 billion has been pledged for Iraqi reconstruction. Is that true?
Well, that's interesting. The coalition of three dozen countries has dwindled significantly. A dozen countries have either withdrawn or have said they will pull out by the end of this year, and that includes three very important countries with large contingents, including Italy, Poland, and the Ukraine. The international community has pledged $34 billion in assistance, but 20 of that is from the United States, and much of that is not yet delivered. Only $2 billion in remaining pledges made more than 2 years ago have been delivered. So in terms of the kind of resources the Iraqis need, that's still lacking, particularly in light of the fact the World Bank estimated that it would need $56 billion. And the coalition is in serious trouble if this, if the Iraqis should slip on the time frame and if the insurgency isn't quelled, at least in some degree, by the end of the year.
Well, Robin Wright, you and others will continue to parse over the speech. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
Robin Wright is a staff reporter for The Washington Post. A new home medical test, as simple as a finger prick, can now reveal a baby's gender just 5 weeks into a pregnancy. Now, there are already options for expecting parents, the ultrasound and the slightly more invasive amniocentesis, but these tests involve waiting until the second trimester of pregnancy. The new test costs about $275 and is being marketed as the Baby Gender Mentor by a company called Mommy's Thinking. Now, while some parents think the kit is the best thing since disposable diapers, others worry that it will result in more terminated pregnancies, abortions based on gender. Before we address those ethical implications, let's find out how it works. Dr. Charles Cantor is a professor of biomedical engineering at Boston University and co-founder of Sequinom. That's a California-based company that researches diagnostic tests, including fetal DNA. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you.
We want to make clear that Sequinom is not at all involved in this baby gender test. But first, can you start by telling us how this test works?
Sure. When a woman is pregnant, the fetus has some programmed cell death. Some cells, mostly in the placenta, die naturally as part of the development of the fetus. And when this happens, they spill DNA fragments into the circulation of the mother.
I see. So these little tidbits of DNA get through the placenta into the mother's bloodstream.
Right. These are naturally occurring. This is a natural, normal process that accompanies pregnancy. And it's possible to spot these fragments of DNA from the fetus. The problem is that natural processes like this are also constantly occurring in the mother. So it's hard to distinguish. In most cases, the DNA that's come from the fetus and the DNA that's come from the mother.
So what exactly is the test looking for?
Okay, in the case of determining the sex of the fetus, what one does is take advantage of the fact that mothers, women, have no Y chromosome.
Uh-huh.
What is measured is the presence of traces of DNA from that particular chromosome, which is totally distinct for males. And if you spot Y chromosomal DNA, this has to mean that the fetus is male.
I see. How long does it take to determine whether the Y chromosome is there?
There are, of course, different, slightly different ways of doing this, but they'll take a few hours to maybe, let's say, 3 to 8 hours, depending on exactly how it's done.
And is there a margin of error?
My own research group, in collaboration with a group in Hong Kong, has carried out these tests on 50 blinded individuals using the Sequinom technology, so I really can only speak to that.
Mm-hmm.
And the test was perfect. There were no mistakes.
You cannot hide that Y chromosome.
You cannot hide it. You'll always see it if it's there. Okay, so you never miss it, and you never misdiagnose it. It's a rare example of a perfect test.
Right. Well, at least perfect in that the results are always correct. As we said, we're going to speak to an ethicist about whether it's perfect in other ways, but what are some other medical applications for testing fetal DNA? Your company doesn't test for gender information, but you do test for other things. What else can you find out?
Right. I have to make one thing very clear so people are not confused. Right now, with the current technology, you can look at what the father contributes to the fetus, but you can't look at what the mother contributes to the fetus.
Why not?
Because the mother has her own DNA in her own circulation, and there's too much of it, and it blinds you to the maternal contribution to the fetal DNA. So you only can look at what the father has contributed, and only if the father has contributed something different from what the mother has contributed.
I see.
All right? So it's not, in that sense, a perfectly informative test. But it is very useful in some cases. Let me first just point out, with regard to the sex test, that in some cases there are very justifiable medical reasons to do this. So if the family is transmitting what we call X-linked disease, like muscular dystrophy, then it's important to exclude the possibility that the fetus is a male.
Because some diseases transfer from gender to gender.
some diseases are only going to affect male offspring. That's where the sex test has clinical value.
And what are some of the diseases that transfer to a certain gender?
Oh, my God, there's a whole list, but the most common by far is muscular dystrophy.
Could you just take 2 seconds and explain that to us? We've gone off on a path here, but it's a fascinating one, because when we heard this first, many of us said, but women have muscular dystrophy. So what do you mean about it transfers only to men?
Right. So there are some kinds of muscular dystrophy that are only commonly seen in males. The genes that cause this disease are carried on the X chromosome, and if you're a male, you only have one X chromosome, and so if it carries the disease gene, you have the disease. In the female, you have two X chromosomes, and so if one of them is normal, you will not get the disease.
Hmm. This is the kind of work that your company, Sequinom, does. You have opted not to provide gender information, which you could easily do. Why not?
Right now, because we don't think it's clinically justified, except in these relatively rare cases. We are more interested experimentally developing non-invasive antenatal tests for other inherited diseases like cystic fibrosis.
Dr. Charles Cantor, again, with a company that tests the DNA of infants to look for possible diseases that are being passed on from a parent. What was your response when you heard about this mommy's thinking test, the baby gender mentor, which tests for gender just so people can know?
I think it's nice to be able to do this in principle, but I just think that it's a dangerous precedent to try to do things like this on a large scale when there is no otherwise clinical benefit to a child. I mean, as you well know, probably, sex selection by selective abortion is practiced widely in certain countries, and most of these have tried to ban this practice. You know, we shouldn't do everything that is that we're capable of doing. On the other hand, the promise of being able to do non-invasive testing for inherited diseases, and I have to stress, that's a promise today. It's not a practice, okay? It needs development. It's going to need several years, at least, of development. But the promise of being able to screen for the health of a fetus is very significant. I mean, that could lead to a substantial improved quality of life on average, for especially in parts of the world where some of these inherited diseases are quite common.
One researcher has even suggested that somewhere down the road, this kind of test could be used to perform a complete genome scan on an embryo.
That's correct. And of course, the real issue where this gets very, very tricky is that right now, if you have a pregnancy and you perform such a test, and the result comes up indicating that the fetus is at risk for major diseases, your only option is to abort. And that's clearly not acceptable to lots of people. Mm. But what will come with time is what's called pre-implantation testing, where you actually, this is already doable today in vitro fertilization situations, where you have the embryo, it has an excess of cells, you can take one of them, and you can determine the genetic properties of the embryo before you implant it. And in that way, you are not doing an abortion. You're just deciding which embryo to implant.
Dr. Charles Cantor, biomedical engineer at Boston University and co-founder of the San Diego-based Sequinom Company, talking to us about another company's new product, which is called the Baby Gender Mentor. Dr. Cantor, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And more on the ethics of gender testing coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and today we've been exploring an aspect of having a baby through a new over-the-counter test that determines a baby's gender just 5 weeks into a pregnancy. We spoke a moment ago with biomedical engineer Dr. Charles Cantor about the science behind the new product called the Baby Gender Mentor. We now turn to bioethicist Arthur Kaplan of the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome, Dr. Kaplan.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, you know, the people at the Mommy's Thinking Company say on their website that the Baby Gender Mentor test is for parents who can't wait to find out what color to paint the nursery whether or not to pick out a name or what name to pick out. What were your first thoughts when you heard about the test?
My honest first thoughts were this test is trouble because it is basically getting involved in testing for something that isn't a disease, isn't a disability, isn't a disorder. Medicine and testing, historically, have been about things that bear on your health. And while your sex can bear on your health indirectly, sex itself, or your gender, at least last time I looked, is not a disease.
Well, in fact, sex can bear on your health, and we'll talk more about that in a second. But, you know, as the website says, this is about picking out colors and getting to know the answer sooner rather than later. I know that you and other ethicists worry that there will be other reasons that people will take the test. What are your concerns?
Well, I do think there are people out there who would say, I want a particular gender baby, and I'm going to stop that pregnancy if I find out that it isn't a boy or it isn't a girl. There are certainly some subpopulations in the United States where that becomes more important, and there are countries outside the United States, India, China, the Philippines, Brazil, where sex still counts and people want boys, particularly in a place like China where there still is pressure to only have one child. So I think you would see some decisions made to end some pregnancies, not just paint the room pink or blue or not just get ready with the tiny baseball glove and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. I think some people would make decisions, if not here then elsewhere, to say, I'm not carrying that pregnancy to term.
Well, and in fact, some people might make that decision based on how many boys or girls they already have. But we understand from studies that, in fact, most people would choose to abort a girl child. And you mm-hmm. pointed to China. And in some countries, that thinking of, aborting a girl child has led to population imbalances.
Right now in China, there are about 120 men per 100 women. It's a real skew. Now, some of that has been the result of infanticide, literally killing, allowing to die girls. And it's causing social problems for China. There are a lot of men around who can't find spouses. Now, if you push me and said, do you really think that's likely to happen in the United States, I'd say no. We have learned to battle more against sexism. But there are some who still would be saying, I just don't want that gender.
Well, and Arthur Kaplan, this takes us, as you always do, down an interesting path, because what exactly are you saying? It is legal to have an abortion in this country. So what are you saying?
Well, you know, I wouldn't ban the test and I wouldn't ban abortion. My position is that at the end of the day, these are choices that people can make. But that doesn't mean you can't talk about the ethics of the choices, and it doesn't mean you can't say morally it's a bad choice to say, I don't want to have a pregnancy because I don't like the fact that this is going to be a girl. I think that there are good reasons to have abortions. There are bad reasons to have abortions. And while we sort of go back and forth over the whole subject of whether abortion itself is ever moral, I think most people understand that there are different reasons, and that having an abortion for reasons of gender is one of the worst reasons.
Well, we mentioned that gender, does it in some rare occasions have something to do with health? Are there instances where you consider using this test to determine whether or not to terminate a pregnancy?
Yes, there are. There are diseases that are sex-linked. We all have heard about hemophilia, and that very tough condition is a disease state in boys, and women are just carriers. There are certainly conditions even worse than that. Huntington's chorea, which tend to run in males, is a strongly inherited genetic disease which kills early and miserable. So you may say, look, for Huntington's disease, I need to know the gender. I'm not going to try and create a person who's going to go through that kind of neurological disease state. And that could be argued, but I understand the merits of that. Mm-hmm. So there are legitimate, appropriate uses of gender and sex testing. There are not a lot of them, but there are some.
Do you think in that case there should be maybe government regulation of this test? Right now, there isn't any.
I do. I think it would be a good principle as a matter of public policy to say no testing without counseling by a human being. Now, maybe that human being could be on the phone. Maybe that human being would direct you to a website for more information or to watch a videotape. I'm not trying to put an onerous financial burden on anybody who's got a biological or a genetic test. But if you're going to use testing and claim that it's accurate and scientific, I think it is a good principle to say we don't test people without counseling them a bit, whether it's their blood pressure, whether it's for HIV, whether it's about a home pregnancy situation. I know there are all kinds of tests that are flying around, some that are online and some you can mail order and some you can do in your house. But you start to get nervous. Are people going to understand it? Who's going to interpret this to them? And remember, if you think about it, Robin, there's a whole slew of new tests coming down the road, new genetic tests we're going to be able to soon look for risk factors for diseases and maybe even start to say who's got freckles and who's going to have a long nose. And I'm still not sure that we want to treat all that as just kind of a matter of taste, a matter of preference. I think we still might want to put it under the medical model.
Mm-hmm. By the way, parents can determine the sex of their baby now with ultrasounds and amnios. What's the difference for you? Is it just the time factor that it's so early in a pregnancy that the baby gender mentor test can be taken so early in the pregnancy? Is that your main concern?
Well, earlier is certainly morally relevant. It seems easier and in some ways perhaps even more tempting to end the pregnancy because for a lot of people, an earlier abortion is less ethically momentous than a later one. But really what the difference is that if you're doing amniocentesis or chorionic villus sampling or these other technical things, even an ultrasound, you're still around somebody who has to explain what it means to you. You're still inside the healthcare system. This thing is sort of off on the side, wink, wink. Why don't you just find out whether you should buy some pants or some dresses? Mm-hmm. But behind the wink is sort of a little more, hey, and you know, there's some information here that if you choose to use it, we're not going to challenge you, push you, make you justify your decision in any way. Go ahead.
Bioethicist Arthur Kaplan teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. Arthur, it's always a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. 3 months after the leader of Northern Ireland's Nationalist Party called for the disarmament of the Irish Republican Army, there is still no word on what the IRA intends to do. That question has stalled the process of returning Northern Ireland to local control. The region's assembly and executive branch were suspended in 2002. Northern Ireland is also in the middle of what is known as marching season, when Protestant parades wind through Catholic neighborhoods, often provoking violence. Well, Peter Hain is a member of the British Parliament and was appointed Secretary of State for Northern Ireland in May of this year. He grew up in South Africa and was active in the anti-apartheid movement. He spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes.
Secretary, you've held the post of Secretary of State for Northern Ireland for about 2 months now, but you've already had a chance to meet all the parties and see what the situation is. In your view, where does the political process in Northern Ireland stand at this moment?
I'm optimistic we can move it all forward. We're all awaiting the IRA statement promised by Gerry Adams, the Sinn Féin leader, when he made a very visionary and courageous speech in April calling for the IRA to choose an exclusively democratic and peaceful path forward. If that is delivered sooner rather than later, and if it is credible and verifiably credible on the ground, that's to say it's not just a public statement, but it actually results in a closing down of a paramilitary activity and criminality activity on the ground, then we can get the negotiations going, and I think there's every prospect of reaching a successful conclusion.
On Monday, you attended a summit hosted by Prime Minister Blair and the Irish Prime Minister, where there were a range of issues dealing with the North discussed. And both before and after the conference, the political leaders said the prospect of getting and restoring inclusive government depends, as you just put it, on the IRA ending all paramilitary and criminal activity. And I'm wondering if realistically you think that's going to happen, or is it, as some other people believe, unlikely?
Well, Gerry Adams, the Sinn Féin leader, was very categorical about the way forward for republicanism as he saw it, which was to end paramilitary activity and to focus for all Republicans on exclusively democratic means. Now, that being the case, I hope the IRA statement will be a momentous and historic one as he has envisaged. And if that is the case, then I do think this opens up a new chapter. And despite the enormous achievements of the Good Friday Agreement 7 years ago and the period of stability and power sharing and economic prosperity that it's brought, there's still the last mile to travel to really put in permanently shared government and peaceful and democratic politics.
You said in early May, shortly after assuming your present role, that you believed it was possible to, quote-unquote, crack the problem if there's goodwill on all sides. And I'm wondering, beyond what Gerry Adams has said, have you seen signs of that?
Yes, I have. In many of the private discussions that I've held with all parties, there were big hurdles there, but there's also a will to move forward. And the conference, the intergovernmental conference that the Irish and British governments held on Monday, to which you referred, was very important in just showing how Dublin and London are joined at the hip in taking a common path forward. Obviously, over the decades and centuries, the relationship between the Irish and British governments has been very difficult. It's strained, tense at times. Now there's no sign of that at all. And what was so crystal clear when Tony Blair and Bertie Ahern stood together as leaders of their governments was how they were saying exactly the same thing. And I think that's had an impact on all the different parties, not least on Sinn Féin and I'm sure on the IRA.
During questioning from Parliament earlier this month, you said that you're more concerned about criminal activity within Northern Ireland and not terrorism. What do you mean by that? What kind of crime are you talking about?
Well, at least when bombs have gone off and violence has happened in the past from the IRA, it's been done in the name of a political objective. For an ideological reason. The problem we now have infecting Northern Ireland society is that the paramilitary groups, Loyalist and Republican, are engaged in criminality, in mafia-type activity, drug running and violent crime and bank robbery and that kind of thing. When that takes root, it's quite difficult to deal with. So there will be that problem, I'm sure, are still around, but what's most important is the paramilitary activity stops.
Are you concerned about more violence during the summer marching season?
Well, we had a bad weekend the weekend before last, but it wasn't as bad as was the case in the past when these parades were really difficult and a lot of people got involved in a lot of troublemaking and violence. So, and then we had last weekend's White Rock Parade, which was expected to be extremely difficult and potential conflict. That was called off, which was very encouraging.
I know you're optimistic or at least hopeful, but what will be done if the IRA doesn't voluntarily agree to give up violence permanently?
Well, I don't want to anticipate the exact terms of the IRA statement, but there's got to be a commitment to end violent activity, the bombings and the shootings on the one hand and the serious organized crime on the other.
One last question, Secretary Hain. When do you hope to hear from the IRA?
Well, I hope it'll be sooner rather than later. I can't be sure. They've not indicated publicly when they are expecting. They've been consulting, we know that, for the last few months, especially over recent weeks, were their own members as to their own preferred course of action. Let's see, you know, a successful, and I hope it'll be a credible and momentous statement sooner rather than later, because then we can get on with the business of putting in place the necessary policies and negotiations to get shared governments between nationalists and unionists, between Republicans and loyalists back on the on track, because it's the only game in town, it's the only show in town, is to have democracy flourishing in Northern Ireland and everybody benefiting from it, and better relations south of the border that lead to increasing contact and cooperation and joint projects. I mean, that's really what the future of the island of Ireland means.
When you say sooner rather than later, I take it you mean while the weather is still warm this year?
Well, we're having a very unseasonably hot weather in Britain at the moment. But I'm not expecting it, tomorrow. But I don't want it to be months and months and months away either. It really is overdue, and the sooner we can get it, the better we can get on with dealing with its consequences, which I hope will be positive.
Right, Honourable Peter Hain, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Bob. Much appreciated.
Peter Hain, the British Secretary of State for Northern Ireland and a Member of Parliament. He spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes. And still to come, a look at the often overlooked early plays of Eugene O'Neill. You're listening to Here and Now. When President Bush spoke before the American people last night, he said the best way to fight the insurgency in Iraq is to help Iraqis build a free nation. But he did not say how that might be done. Yesterday, we spoke with Khalif Sepp, a former Special Forces lieutenant colonel who's conducted counterinsurgencies in Central America and is now a defense analyst at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. His recent article, Best Practices in Counterinsurgency, appears in the May-June issue of Military Review. Well, in light of President Bush's speech, we thought we'd share more of Colonel Sepp's thoughts on how exactly the U.S. might fight the Iraqi insurgency, which is made up largely of Sunni Iraqis. He began by quoting another counterinsurgency expert, James Corum.
James Corum just wrote, he said, counterinsurgency is not rocket science. If it were, we'd be better at it. Americans love technology. They constantly want to apply technologies to solve these kind of problems. Insurgency is actually very simple, very straightforward, but it's hard. Getting the people on your side, that takes a long time. And there's a way to do that. You have to be very methodical about it and say, okay, we are going to this suburb of Fallujah, we're going to secure this suburb. And you focus all your resources, your security, all your planners, all your civil affairs efforts, all your engineering efforts on that area until it's completely stable, secure, in and of itself. And then you expand, then you go to another zone. Mm-hmm. And you can be doing this simultaneously in, you know, lots of different places. But if you do something like the Marine Corps, you know, tough fighters, terrific warriors, but when they did that sweep north of the Euphrates, you know, they go into a town, they find some guerrillas, in the process of fighting them, they shoot the whole town up, and then they leave. And they leave a vacuum, which the guerrillas move right back into. And then, oh, by the way, anybody that cooperated with the Americans is punished. You're really not making any progress, and actually you're setting things back, because now the lesson to the population is, whatever you do, don't help the Americans.
Right, because the guerrillas are coming right behind them.
That's right. The Americans don't stay, and the guerrillas will come back and kill you for helping. That's why the importance of distinguishing priorities and having soldiers understand that. I'm not saying that soldiers should unnecessarily expose themselves, sacrifice themselves. That's not the point. And that's how some American commanders take it when you say, well, that's not your priority. They sort of puff out their chest and say, you know, well, I'm just supposed to throw my men's lives away. Well, no, police don't do that. Counterinsurgency is much more like police work than it is conventional war fighting. And if you think about, you know, the way a policeman thinks about resolving problems and if he has to apply lethal force, how he does it, soldier sees a combatant, enemy combatant, running down a street, and he raises his rifle, and his objective is fire as much ammunition as he can, as quickly as he can, to knock the guy down. But a policeman looks at who's around. You know, what if I miss? Where does the bullet go? Am I sure that that's the guy that I want? And it's a very, very different mentality.
But you're saying fight a counterinsurgency sort of as a police action, protect the civilians, which ultimately better protects the U.S. soldiers because it starts to eliminate the insurgents.
Most people don't want war and disruption and have their lives threatened every day. And if once you secure an area or you start securing an area and you link that to, you know, if you help us get rid of the guerrillas here, you'll have water, electricity, the sewers will work, but you have to help us. And they'll do that, and then they'll keep doing it. And the way common citizens do that is simply describing, you know, is reporting what goes on, because you just can't. People in the neighborhood, everybody knows what goes on. You know, there really is. You can draw a very close analogy to any neighborhood in America. Like, you know, when I lived in Somerville, there was a wonderful lady who walked up and down the street four times a day for her exercise. But she knew who lived where and who was having babies and whose cousin was visiting from Connecticut, and all neighborhoods are like that.
Right.
That's where you get intelligence. And when you get the intelligence, then you can break down the insurgency. Insurgencies are intelligence wars.
Lieutenant Colonel Khalif Sepp is a defense analyst who may return later this summer to Iraq to advise the Pentagon on fighting counterinsurgencies. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And here's a roundup of other stories in the news today. Gay marriage is one step closer to being legal in all of Canada. Legislators in the House of Commons voted yesterday to legalize same-sex marriages, and now that bill moves to the Senate, where it is expected to pass and become law by the end of July. Canada's Ontario and British Columbia had already legalized gay marriage, and the Netherlands and Belgium are the only other two countries that allow same-sex marriage, Massachusetts the only U.S. state. The redesigned Freedom Tower will be unveiled in New York City today. The original design, at the center of what was once the World Trade Center, was met with criticism from the city's police department because it was too close to a street and would be vulnerable to an attack by a truck bomb. The new plans for the tower that will honor the victims of 9/11 will position it 90 feet back from the street with a blast-resistant base. In New Hampshire, officials in the town of Weir received a fax yesterday from a man who wants Supreme Court Justice David Souter's farmhouse. Souter joined in the court's 5-4 decision last week that ruled local governments can seize private property and give it to a private concern if it would benefit the public. Well, Californian Logan Darrow Clements says he wants the state to seize Souter's farm so he can build a new hotel, which would in turn bring the town economic development and tax revenue. In Russia, President Vladimir Putin pocketed the 2005 Super Bowl ring of New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft. The two met at a meeting of American business executives. Kraft showed his ring to Putin, who then tried it on, put it in his pocket, and left. The ring is encrusted with 124 diamonds, and while the team won't say how much the ring is worth, they say it is much more than $15,000. It's unclear if the ring was purloined. There is a chance Kraft may have given it as a gift since he has two more at home. A Patriots spokeswoman says she's spoken to her boss and he didn't say whether he's asked for it back, a topic we suspect one might raise gingerly. American regional theaters continue to turn to this country's classic playwrights, but increasingly with a difference. Oh, the best-known plays of Eugene O'Neill, for instance, are still being staged. They include A Long Day's Journey into Night. But some of O'Neill's lesser-known early works are also being produced. Just this past month, early O'Neill plays Desire Under the Elms and Anna Christie hit the footlights. So Here Now's theater critic Bill Marks joins us in the studio to talk about the early plays of O'Neill. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Robin.
Well, isn't Long Day's Journey enough? You know, the common wisdom, I thought, was that Eugene O'Neill wrote his best plays at the end of his life.
And that holds true, that A Long Day's Journey into Night, Iceman Cometh, and Moon for the Misbegotten are considered to be the most brilliant plays that he wrote. But he's such a giant in American literature that regional theaters are always looking for plays in the past that did well when they first premiered. Mm-hmm. And a Christie won a Pulitzer Prize. It was the first Pulitzer Prize that O'Neill won. And it did very well on Broadway. And it's also a play that O'Neill did, which is, I almost want to say, has a happy ending. I mean, it's the closest to a cheery O'Neill play that there is, about a woman, a fallen woman, who meets with a sailor and he finds out about her past and forgives her. And so for O'Neill, that's a happy birthday party with balloons. And also, I mean, a lot of people may remember Anna Christie from the film version, which came out in the early 30s, and it was the first talking role for Greta Garbo. And here are the first words out of Garbo's mouth as Anna Christie.
Give me a whiskey. Ginger it on the side. And don't be stingy, baby.
Greta Garbo in the film version of Anna Christie. And by the way, was that where the headlines came from, Garbo Talks?
That's exactly, and that's what you end up saying. I mean, for Garbo, I mean, it was sort of an interesting choice. For MGM, it was a very sort of a dour film. And for her, it was certainly not glamorous, but it was sort of a happy fable about a fallen woman who learns redemption through love.
And again, as you said, one of Eugene O'Neill's happier plays. Can you list a couple of other early plays of Eugene O'Neill?
Morning Becomes Electra. People may be familiar with that Civil War epic. The Hairy Ape which actually has been revived quite successfully by a number of theaters because they use this sort of de-evolution of man. This is a sailor who sort of ends up at the end of the play in a zoo with a lot of monkeys, and it's sort of like O'Neill's satire of Darwinian evolution, except it's devolution.
Right, in reverse.
In reverse, and it can be done very powerfully. And of course, Desire Under the Elms, people may remember that from an interesting film version, which starred Burl Ives, Sophia Loren, and Anthony Perkins.
Now, there's a group you don't see at a dinner party.
Yeah, not really. I mean, this is a play one often doesn't see at a dinner party. It's O'Neill's attempt to do sort of a Greek tragedy set in New England with this sort of accent, which I think was sort of a New England-y farmer, you know, boy, it's looking purdy out there, that I don't think was ever really spoken by any real living human beings.
Right. Well, and that might explain why you don't see some of these plays very often. I mean, just that criticism of that one play.
Well, that play, the problem with O'Neill is that he spent his entire life struggling with language. I mean, he had an undoubted artistic brilliance, and his vision was searing, but his language was the problem. And he often couldn't find the right words to match. He wanted to create poetry on the stage, as in Desire Under the Elms, which is about an older man who brings in a young wife, and the son gets the hots for the wife, and the young wife gets hots for the son. Thus, tragedy follows. You know, I mean, that could have worked had you found a real language for it, but O'Neill didn't.
Well, still the most performed, probably the most popular of O'Neill's plays, A Long Day's Journey Into Night. Let's listen to a clip from the movie version of that play. It stars Katharine Hepburn and Dean Stockwell. Set this up for us.
This is a wonderful film version by Sidney Lumet. And in this particular scene, Dean Stockwell, who's playing the young Eugene O'Neill, is going to his mother and essentially saying, "Ma, you got to listen to me. I'm sick."
"You haven't asked me what I found out this afternoon. Don't you care a damn?"
"Don't say that. You hurt me, dear."
"What I've got is serious, Mama. Doc Hardy knows for sure
now." "That lying old quack. I warned you he'd invent something."
"He called in a specialist to examine."
"Don't tell me about Dr. Hardy. If you heard what the doctor at the sanatorium, who really knows something, said about how he treated me, he said it was a wonder I hadn't gone mad. I told him I had once, that time I ran down in my nightdress to throw myself off the dock. You remember that, don't you? And you want me to pay attention to what Dr. Hardy says? Oh, no."
"Listen, Mama. I'm going to tell you whether you want to hear it or not. I've got to go away to a sanatorium."
A lot of people believe Eugene O'Neill's A Long Day's Journey Into Night is autobiographical. I want your thoughts. Is it? And then I'm wondering how many of his plays are autobiographical, and is that another reason to go back and plumb the early ones?
Both of those are good questions. The first question is that, I mean, a lot of critics, and I have felt that a lot of, particularly the late plays, are very autobiographical, but there's an interesting new book by Doris Alexander called Eugene O'Neill's Last Play, Separating Art from Autobiography, and she meticulously, somewhat too meticulously at times, goes through all the plays, goes through O'Neill's life, and really separates fact from fiction in the plays, and it turns out to be a lot more fiction in the plays than have been accepted. So in a sense, it's for those who think, oh, this is giving us a view of O'Neill's life, then you might be a little disappointed. For those of you who worship him as a creative artist, then you see how much more imagination and fantasy went into the plays. And in a sense, I think it makes them more, not less powerful. Now, as for your other question, I don't think he turned to autobiography until the end of his life, really. In a sense, all of his early plays are building up. I don't want to say they're a defense, but they're a way of things he has to get through, things he has to get out before he can finally turn to himself, his own life, and perhaps finding a language in order to, you know, to get his vision of life out. So I think they're turning to the early plays partly because there is some dramatic gold in them hills still, and also that he's such a major figure that people are interested in the evolution of an artist.
Mm. Here now is theater critic Bill Marks on Eugene O'Neill. For more information, by the way, on the plays we spoke of, go to our website, here-now.org. Bill, as always, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.